If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 456, Ready for Anything, with guest Hal Brill, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. It seems winter has finally relented. We've had a couple of days above freezing, we've had some rain, the snow is starting to melt. It seems as though the promise of spring will be kept. Now I have my doubts. In this episode of the Sea Realm Podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded last week with Hal Brill. Hal is one of three co-authors of a book called The Resilient Investor, A Plan for Your Life, Not Just Your Money. And if you listened to last week's show, you heard a reading from the book. You know it's not your typical investment tome. And if you didn't hear last week's show, well, you'll know more about what I mean in just a couple of minutes. I have quite a bit to share with you, so I have very little in the way of introductory remarks on this episode. I do want to say, though, that the music that you will hear in the middle is by Brody Kinder. The song is called Walking Dead, and Brody lives in the same town in western Colorado as Hal. And it was at Hal's suggestion that I'm playing this song. There will be a link to Brody Kinder's EP in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on crealm.com. All right, let's get to it.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and I am joined by Hal Brill from Western Colorado via Skype. Hal, welcome to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Oh, nice to be with you, KMO.
And this isn't the first time that you and I have been in the Sea Realm together, but it's the first time that we've been in the Sea Realm together at the same time so that we can talk to each other. As I understand, you've listened to quite a few episodes.
Yeah, you've actually been quite an influence on my putting this book together the last couple of years. Really appreciated the insights I'd get from so many different perspectives on the Sea Realm.
I was remarking to the Sea Realm listeners on last week's show that it's not many investment books that I know of, in fact, just one, that mentions Ray Kurzweil, Guy McPherson, Charles Eisenstein, and James Howard Kunstler.
Yeah, when I heard your lead-in last week, it just cracked me up because you were kind of warning the Sea Realm audience that you hadn't gone off the deep end doing an investment book. And I've had a similar sort of path and people wondering, what is Hal doing in the investment world? Pretty unlikely candidate to be in that world. But it's turned out to be a really fascinating journey.
Well, what is it about you and your background that makes people sort of scratch their head when they hear that you're working in investment?
Well, it's probably my deep financial background, which took the form of a degree of cultural geography at the university in Berkeley, followed by several years of doing environmental education, followed by joining a group called Walk for the Earth to walk across the country when I was 28 back in 1984, and followed by walking across Europe in the following year. So it wasn't exactly your Wharton School of Business material in my 20s there. Yeah. So afterwards, I got to, after those travels, I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And at that point, I was really focused on looking for alternatives to how people could live in a integrated way to create a model of something that would be sustainable into the future. So my focus at that point was actually trying to help create an eco-village, a demonstration eco-village in Santa Fe. So that was kind of the precursor to any of this investment work.
Does that eco-village still exist as an eco-village?
You know, we made some good headway, but we never actually formed the eco-village. What we did instead as as an initial step was we opened up a city center in Santa Fe called the SEED Institute. It stood for Community Economic and Ecological Development. And we were doing all the sort of urban things that we could to create an economic base. We had a healing arts center. We had an eco-product store. We had meeting rooms. We were selling eco-products and arts, supporting local artisans. So we got that going for a couple of years as a way of hopefully launching the rural project. But like many projects that many of us had high hopes for back in our younger years, we were never able to completely bring it to fruition. But we feel like we've moved the ball, especially in the Santa Fe area. There was a lot of elements of ecological living that, you know, have certainly worked their way into the discourse there and into planning ideas. So it was certainly a useful and fruitful period of my life. But what came out of that was, you know, and thinking about from a kind of a younger idealistic way of, wow, I want to do this big eco village. How are we going to get 100 or more people to go out to a piece of land and create some kind of sustainable situation out there? And it all started coming back into finances and economics and how to make it all flow. So my first real foray into that was joining the board of a community loan fund in New Mexico. There were Native Americans, there were nuns from Catholic orders, there were progressive hippies, there were all sorts of us coming together. And we put out for investment capital. People loan money to the pool. And our first investment was to an organic farmer who wanted to put up an organic greenhouse. And banks wouldn't lend to organic farmers to put up a greenhouse at that point. So we were able to make the loan, and he was able to pay it back. And I saw him the following year at the farmer's market with a whole bunch of beautiful produce much earlier than he would have been able to produce otherwise. And it was a little glimmer of inspiration for me that, well, maybe this financial world could be used in ways that would be productive for people and for the planet.
It would seem difficult to imagine a scenario in which it's used in a worse way than what we see coming from Wall Street.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, last week you read a little bit from the missing fourth strategy. You know, we'll talk about how the system works in the book, I'm sure. But yeah, business as usual, which we call "Show Me the Money," is it's had a lot of benefits. I think it's hard to argue that the ability to bring capital together and do large-scale projects is phenomenal. It's, you know, obviously we've moved light years in the way people lived a few hundred years ago, and the tools of capitalism and Wall Street have certainly played a big part in that. So I don't like to come across, you know, simply as one of those who's always barking and sneering at Wall Street, although I started out that way. and now we're looking at ways, well, can we do more of an Aikido move with Wall Street? Can we use what it does well and put it on a path of promoting things that represent the real needs of people and the earth? And that's, of course, a huge quest, and lots of structures are in place that make it difficult to do that, but fortunately there's many, many people who are working on that path, and we're starting to see some headway.
As you say, it would take a really staunch and committed ideologue to deny the benefits of economic development along the industrial capitalist model. And yet there are a couple of closely related concepts that I think are very important, but when I just say them, given the names that I know for them, they sound really wonkish and sort of impenetrable. And I'm wondering maybe if you have some clearer, simpler language for explaining the concepts of diminishing returns and negative marginal returns.
Boy, I've been really looking at those lately. No, I'm afraid I don't have really good, clear, succinct language. They are pretty wonky, and I agree with you. They are absolutely essential, and they just seem to be entering the, the noosphere right now as far as what we're realizing, that capitalism has gotten a lot of the easy pickings. It's been able to, especially with the whole peak oil narrative, where there was a cheap source of fossil fuels, there were cheap sources of labor, there was limitless supply of land and labor out there to bring all these things together. But, my understanding of those concepts is that as you go on, as you get the easy pickings, and I think any gleaner would realize this, the rest of the stuff gets harder to get, and you got to put out more energy to get it. And people are coming to the realization, it's still controversial, it's only a few people are coming to this realization, but there's the feeling that the capitalist system as a whole might actually be coming to the end of the era of easy pickings. And we're wondering what's going to happen next. So I was very heartened to see this fall in Germany, the Degrowth Conference attracted 3,500 people to discuss that very topic of, what happens if the paradigm of endless economic growth on a finite planet can't keep going forever? And what would it look like? And how can we create rewarding, fulfilling lives for all people, not just a few people at the top, and safeguard the biological systems that we all depend on for future generations? It's, there's just incredible conversations going on right now that are really exciting to be a part of.
In the context of just this one conversation, we cannot relate all of the content of your book, and we wouldn't want to anyway. I mean, people should certainly read it. But in talking about it, what are the most basic concepts that we should lay out before diving deeper?
Well, there's two, and they're both in the title. It's called The Resilient Investor. And one has to do with that pesky title, that pesky word investing that we hinted at the beginning of the talk, in that investing is usually thought of as something that's done by those who have extra money to turn it into even more money, using methods promoted by Wall Street. So when you put that idea of investing in your head, you think of, piles of coins and people in suits, and it's a pretty impenetrable, certainly not a warm and connected kind of feeling that comes with investing. And indeed, we played around with not having investor in the title. But we really think it's important that people claim that title, that we're all investors, we're all making investments all the time, every day. And even those who don't have money, have extra financial resources to invest, are certainly making investments. We invest our time, we invest our energy, we invest our heart and our love, our attention, the things we focus on. Those are all investments, and I think in many ways they are the most important investments that we do. So that's one of the really big pieces of the book, is to get over the separation that some people have. That's just talking with an investor and about investing in local farms, and she was talking about how it's really important for her to separate out the financial bottom line from all the values. She loves farms, but you got to talk about the money part of it, and it really goes into a really deep split in people's souls and psyches. So we're hoping that making investing into a topic that people can relate to is a service and creates some healing for people and this whole idea.
I don't know who the author of this quote is, but I recall somebody saying that if you don't have a plan for your money, somebody else does. And when you talk about investing and you include investing your time and both investing your attention, your focus, not just, you know, excess money. It occurs to me that a great many people, probably most people, are investing an enormous chunk of their life's energy and their time in making somebody else rich, and doing so in a way that impoverishes themselves and their own communities and even their children's future. And so if you don't have an investment strategy for your time, and if you don't have an investment strategy for your personal dynamic energy, well, there is a default strategy that will suck you in if you don't make an effort to swim against that stream or that current. And I wonder what general advice you can give to somebody who's just starting to think in those terms for the first time about breaking out of default programs that are really unhelpful.
Well, one thing that I've been really heartened is talking to millennials and younger people about this whole idea. When we're very fortunate to work with a great publisher named Barrett Kohler, who's a B Corp that some of your listeners might be familiar with, and they're values-oriented companies. So one thing they do is they bring in their entire staff to meet the authors of every book that they publish. And that includes some interns and younger people, and they said that, well, sometimes those younger folks are kind of snoozing through some of the more esoteric topics that they have. But when we presented the Resilient Investment Map, we talked about your personal assets, your tangible assets, and your financial assets. And they could see themselves in that map. They got it. They realized that they're not going to be able to set aside $2,000 a year into their IRA and retire with $1 million. They're in San Francisco. The thought of even getting a home and a place to live, owning it themselves, all the things that worked for generations in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s aren't really paying off dividends. So younger people just get this intuitively. And, you know, so when we talked about being resilient and the fact that a younger person just starting out who has no financial resources but has a lot of personal assets, connections, they know how to network, they know how to do a lot of different things, they're more resilient than a fat cat from Wall Street who's got everything tied up in big investments with hedge funds and investment companies, because those fat cats can be incredibly vulnerable to the systemic risks that we face, whereas the younger person, being more resilient, is nimble and able to adapt to a changing situation. So I think a lot of it is really just coming about generationally and naturally.
You mentioned the phrase resilient investing map. What is that?
Mm-hmm. So my co-authors and I, I'm part of a company with two other partners. We're called Natural Investments. Michael Kramer and Christopher Peck and myself are the three partners of Natural Investments. We decided to write a new book. I'd written a book about 15 years ago about money and values. And we didn't want to just rehash these old ideas about, you know, about having your money, having your values, and putting that together. That's the field of sustainable and responsible investing, SRI, and that's one I've been in ever since those days of trying to start an eco-village 25 years ago. But we wanted to come up with something that's really important for the times. And the word resilience, the whole idea of resilience, has really burst onto the scene in a big way the last few years, and with good reason. Sustainability is a concept that we love, but it implies sort of a steady state that doesn't seem to really be achievable right now. Sustainable fisheries, sustainable forestry, those are the healthy expressions of it. Sustainable packaging for Barbie dolls, maybe not so such a healthy expression of it. But at any rate, we're seeing that we are having extreme weather events, we're having extreme financial events, and this idea of just getting to a place where we're going to be okay because everything's in balance is seeming less and less realistic, whereas being resilient, being able to bounce back, is an idea that
everybody can relate to.
So that's what underlied our latest book, was how can we help people to become resilient, to make choices in their life that will meet their needs today, but will also prepare them for the various futures that we may encounter in these really unpredictable, complex times.
So what is the resilient investment map? What is the map part of it?
Oh, so picture drawing out a tic-tac-toe, you know, where you've got nine squares. And along the left side, we have the three kinds of assets that we've been talking about. You have your personal assets, which is everything between your physical and emotional health, and also your relationships. So really they're personal assets, social assets, interpersonal, transpersonal, all those go on that row. In the second row are your tangible assets. That's the real stuff that you have. Maybe you're fortunate to own a home, maybe you have a car, maybe you've got some beloved devices, maybe you're really plugged in with community gardens. You don't actually have to own them yourself, but they're assets, they're tangible, real things. And of course, the ultimate tangible, real thing that we all have is the planet and the way it supports us in living and our communities. And then the third row is what people think of as investing, the financial assets. You know, real money. Where is your money? So those are the three rows. Across the top are the columns. And the columns, we have three different strategies that you can use to invest those different assets. And the first column we call close to home. Close to home is everything's local. It's about where you are. If you're familiar with permaculture, they work with different zones, where zone zero is right inside where you are, and zone one right near your house, and zone two moving out. So your communities can move out into your region. It's a lot of ways to define what you mean by local. I live in Western Colorado. That's pretty spread out. So I think in terms of quite a bit of area as being close to home. Whereas in a neighborhood like Brooklyn, close to home might be in your block or your neighborhood. The second column is the sustainable global economy, a bit of a mouthful, but that's where we engage with the structures of the global economy the way they are. And because we put that wonderful word sustainable in front of there, our advice is to engage with the global economy in ways that move it in a more sustainable direction. And then the third column is evolutionary investing, and that takes it into a really interesting realm. Evolutionary we use in the sense that we want to move the ball forward, that we're coming into an era where we need all the good ideas that are out there to start to come into fruition, whether it's how we deal with the planet, with each other, economically, in technology, in our interiors, how we evolve personally. So by using an evolutionary framework, we're encouraging people to think about the future in a proactive way and play a role in helping that future come into existence. So those are the three strategies: close to home, global economy, and evolutionary. And they interact with the personal assets, tangible assets, and financial assets. And they create these nine boxes like a tic-tac-toe board. And our advice to people, if you want to be resilient, is that you need to pay attention to all nine of those zones, is what we call them in the map.
And most investment strategies and books on investment are just dealing with one cell out of those nine. Which one is it?
Exactly. So obviously they're dealing with financial assets and they're dealing with the global economy. So that is zone eight in our map. And we have eight other zones for people to pay attention to. So this isn't a book to pick up if you really want to keep it simple. Unfortunately, you're going to need to think in a broader way if you want to be successful in the future. You need to think about more than your money, and you need to think about more than the current global economy that we live in, because there is a possibility that we could live through an era of systemic change. And Wall Street has very little to say to help protect people from the possibility of systemic change. Wall Street is based on looking at past performance, diversifying in these baskets of stocks and bonds, and we have small cap stocks and large cap stocks and international and growth and value and bonds and all these little ways that Wall Street teaches you about diversifying. And that's been a great system. It's really important in the realm in which it came from, and it's still important for people to know about those things. But when the whole system goes down, it's not going to offer the kind of protection that people need. And we just about lived through that just a few years ago. So in our mind, that was a warning signal. And that's what motivated us to come out with an investing book that focuses on being resilient.
Bayonets piercing everyone, inception, but we're biters, the walking dead. We're living in a zombie apocalypse.
Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound?
Watch me now.
Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound?
Stock up on luck, fill up your shelves. Lock up your dreams, we'll get through hell. Hit the meat knocks, tell them I'm gone. Watch out for the hands with that chloroform that's held over our mouth when we're trying to be ourselves. It's so hard to be just that you can't buy it off the shelf. There's no jobs in this economy for my friends with the college degree. Numb to hypocrisy, corporations own the land of the free. Where are you now? Starting an evolution.
Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound? Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound?
Whoa. Vote Rachel, my name. Compassion is a cure. Vote Rachel, my name. Compassion is a cure. Vote Witcher, my name. Compassion is a cure. Vote Witcher, my name. It's not an evolution.
Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound? Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound? Get up, come on, make a sound now. Rise up, when they strike you down. Get up to get down. Are you down with the sound?
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast with your host, KMO.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Hal Brill, who is one of three authors of The Resilient Investor, A Plan for Your Life, Not Just Your Money. Hal, before the musical break, you were talking about how this book is not really for somebody who's looking to keep it simple. This book is dealing with a future which will be marked by not only complexity, but also volatility, uncertainty, and ambiguity. And those four things together, VUCA, is an acronym that the military uses in charting a course into a future which they realize is quite complicated. One, V-U-C-A. When you say that, how do you pronounce it?
I say it VUCA.
Okay. VUCA. It's a safer way to say it.
VUCA. Yes, I think so.
In the book, you describe four, not necessarily four literal futures that would play out in an exclusive way, but four sort of frameworks on the future. The quick, sudden collapse, the long struggle down, the long struggle up, and then a breakthrough where things get better, much better, very quickly. What's the purpose in framing the book in terms of those four potential futures?
We found that people tend to get locked in their own mindset pretty easily. All of us do that. It seems to be a natural tendency to have this cognitive bias, and especially now it's so easy to go out and find sources that reinforce our positions. So the most helpful tool that we found out there to break out of that mold is called scenario planning. And that's something the military does, the corporations do. It can be done in a very deep and sophisticated way. We distilled down that process to something that's really pretty darn simple and obvious. Things are basically the way they are. They could basically stay the way they are, or they could get worse, or they could get better. It's almost too obvious to state. And yet, so many people I know are completely locked into one of those three positions. We have, you know, we certainly have a lot of people on the status quo is the way things have been and the way things will always be. And that's the view that you'll read in most of the mainstream media, mainstream financial press. They're looking at changes around the edges, but the basic system that we have, or if you want to define the system of economic growth, of nation states, of military-industrial complex, of the basic rules of investing, yeah, I would say the vast majority of people in our country are pretty confident that what you see is what you get, and it'll keep going that way. And voices expressing some doubt about that are often relegated to the fringe. So the reason we shaped the book the way we did is to talk to both of those groups of people. We wanted people who are really locked into the mainstream view of how humans have organized ourselves to at least open their mind a little bit to the possibility that things may not continue the way they've been percolating along in such a familiar way. So that's where I started diving into some of the resources that I got, you know, many of which I got from the C-Realm in looking at what the implications of complexity were, Joseph Tainter's seminal work there, and other work on collapse, and the various voices of authors and bloggers out there who are pointing out the very cogent case that a lot of the structures that we rely on and take for granted could be much more fragile than they appear. So that really led to this whole, let's really look breakdown in the eye, and using James Howard Kunstler's term, the long emergency, which so beautifully put, really gets people to think about that. Wow, what would a future look like, and how, you know, should I be preparing for that future, at least partially? Do I give some credence to the possibility that that could happen in my lifetime? And if so, what am I doing to prepare for that? So that's on the, that's on the, obviously, the negative side of systemic change. And on the positive side, we certainly have all the singularity folks out there talking about how technology will change everything. We're going to come up with new energy sources. We're going to get through, we can reintroduce species that have gone extinct. We can recreate ecosystems. There's some amazing, wonderful things going through on the visionary realms. I love listening to Stuart Brand's Long Now series to just to open my mind to what people are thinking about as real possibilities to where we could be going. And you know, that one we called Rational Emergence, to, you know, play off Alan Greenspan's term there. But rational emergence implies that it would actually be rational to take all the tools and all the wisdom that's accumulated through all of human history that we have access to now and to put those into place and really get on with creating the world that we want to see.
There's a Canadian science fiction author named Carl Schrader, and he said something that I thought was really brilliant and quite simple. He said, if you are really committed to a particular future, if you are absolutely certain that you know how the future is going to go, then really what you're doing is describing the one future that won't surprise you. And he said that in conversation with a devoted singularitarian, saying, look, there are some other possible futures you should take into consideration.
You know, I love that thought. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right, but Jaime Caseo, who we quote in the book about scenario planning, he talks about doing this kind of work as sort of an immunization, in that if you've thought about breakdown, if you've thought about breakthrough, if you've thought about the different ways that our system, our muddling along system, can move in a positive or negative direction, you'll be prepared. So I just think it's a really essential tool for people to do it as an exercise. Even if you're 100% convinced we're going one direction or another, just do it as a mental exercise and consider, well, what would it look like? You know, we're starting to see a little bit of backlash from the dystopian sci-fi, as you've talked about, and people that are proudly proclaiming themselves as utopians. A group out of Tucson that's the Hieroglyph Project, and others that are, well, let's actually envision where we want to go and think backwards from there. If we can imagine where we want to go, what are the steps that we need to take now in order to get to that future? And that's really the heart of what our evolutionary strategy is about. It's like, can you put 5 or 10% of your investment energy, whether it's financial or tangible or personal, can you put a little bit of it towards moving us towards that world that you'd like to see in the future? You know, most people can relate to that idea.
I'd like to read something from your book and have you either expand on it or maybe say something which is necessary to fully understand it. This is from very early in the book. It's in chapter one. Nobody knows when the next shock will hit the financial system. But if there is one lesson to learn, it was that investors need to update their risk management toolbox. We are not willing to accept that there is no way to address systemic risks, and neither should you. A resilient investing plan will enrich your life in today's world while hedging against, if you choose, or if you choose, preparing for, the possibility that our fundamental social, economic, and environmental reality could shift in profound ways.
Yes, that's a great encapsulation of what we've been talking about in being ready for anything. And we almost named the book Ready for Anything. That was another idea. And how can you be ready for anything? You have to be sort of like a martial artist. And we use that analogy in the book of having the 10,000 eyes, of looking in all directions, of being prepared, taking a blow now and then, but being able to roll with it and having an intention of where you want to go and being able to move forward. So it really is like being a dancer, a martial artist in these times when things are changing so quickly, so unpredictably. There's black swans coming at us left and right. There's also white swans coming out that we might not see. And we want to be ready for all of that, to take advantage of the opportunities that are there and be prepared for the possibilities that things could get harder at the same time. It's that idea of taking advantage of opportunities, I think, separates us a little bit from what people have in their head about resilience. The idea of being resilient is often taken as bouncing back from a hard situation. You know, somebody's just lost a spouse, and 2 years later they're in a new relationship and their career is blossoming and they're doing great. You know, that's what we think of as resilience. But there's another aspect to it, and that's the ability to actually improve from the adversity. Nassim Taleb, you know, he wrote the book about the black swan, but his newest book is called Anti-Fragile. And we love his inspiration there, which is that some things, including life itself, takes advantage of adversity and creates a product that's better than it was before. So that's the kind of mindset we're hoping to encourage people with, and not just leave them in a place where, oh my God, this shit's going to hit the fan and I got to get ready here.
I wonder if you've heard from anybody who picked up the book expecting a more traditional sort of investment guide and was surprised and possibly not thrilled to find what you had in store for them.
Well, the book's only been out a couple of weeks, so we haven't gotten that kind of feedback yet. Mostly it's friends and families and people that have been looking forward to seeing it. So I'm sure we will. In my previous writing career, of the earlier book was called Investing with Your Values. That one pushed some buttons for some people because it really was trying to make the case that you can invest, and we're talking about financial investments, not specifically there. So you can invest your money in ways that are in alignment with your social, your environmental values, with your ethical values, and you can make just as much money investing your money that way as you can investing in the way Wall Street tells you, which is to put some blinders on, slip your money through a dark crack in that wall of Wall Street, don't pay any attention to what the money's doing, and that's the only way to invest. You can't let values interfere with making financial decisions. So there's been lots of arguments with people in our field about that, and we have really good data to show that our position is actually backed up by reality. There's stock indexes that are chosen using social values, environmental values to make the selections. We're avoiding the worst polluters or avoiding the worst corporate offenders in various areas, limiting our range of investments, but we're making just as much money as the call them dirty investors, but the values agnostic investors. So that's where we tend to get into some lively discussions with mainstream investors.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I'd like to have you tell folks about the website for the book.
Sure. We put what I learned in writing a book 15 years ago and writing a book now is that people have shorter attention spans and you need to write a short book. So my last book would be considered a doorstop, and we got this one down to 150 pages. But I'm sure, as people can tell from our conversation, it covered a lot of different topics. So we offloaded some of that into the website. It's www.resilientinvestor.com, and there's a section with a deeper dive and a blog that we're just getting going, and we'd love to have conversations about these areas. Yeah, well, our blog, I think, is going to really focus in part on looking at these various future scenarios and how to look at them and people representing different views and how to incorporate that into your own resilient investing plan. But the main thing, you can also download a map and see the map right on the website, so you don't even need to buy the book in order to get familiar with the material. But the book will really guide you in a step-by-step way to filling out your own resilient investing map. And that's really where the value of this work is going to come through. You can read about it and think about it, but it's really important that people take some time, take out a piece of paper, think about their own life, see what they're doing in the 9 different zones, and what that reveals about their own worldview and where they want to go and how they might chart a way forward in these complex times. The other website we have is www.naturalinvestments.com, Natural Investments is the company that I co-founded with my father, and now have two partners that are both co-authors of the book, and we've been helping values-based investors get their money aligned, and we work in a very holistic way with our amazing clients. It's a real honor. Yeah, I've learned so much from my clients in having these kind of heart-to-heart conversations about where we are personally, where we want to go, and how do we move forward. So that's another resource, and we put a lot of information on that website as well.
Well, Hal, I thank you very much for sending me the book, and thanks for joining me here on the CROM podcast.
Well, thanks for your help in pointing me to some wonderful resources, KMO, and what a privilege to talk with you. Have a good day.